I mentioned in my announcements about Feast of Tabernacles, and it can be such a highlight, if you will, of the year for God's people, not only because we get to spend a tenth of our income pretty much in the matter of a week or so, that's a pretty good thing, but also just all of the spiritual food that we get, that we're just immersed in God's Word, and it's easy sometimes to come home and just kind of feel let down, right? Because now we're back to our regular life, back to our jobs. The seasons are changing. Tonight, you have to stop your clocks or turn them back an hour. You know, we're losing daylight, not really, but time-wise, you know, we're losing daylight at the end of the year now, and winter is ahead of us, and all of that can be just kind of depressing if we don't keep the right perspective. I hope that you had a truly wonderful feast, as I mentioned, and that the messages where you were extremely helpful and beneficial to you, and especially in the coming winter months. But we also need to keep in mind what all those days picture, right? As we move forward, I'm always encouraged by the meaning of those days to consider that for 1,000 years, Christ is going to show mankind how to live that has never been modeled before for them. And what that world will look like, we can only imagine, if you will. We have bits and pieces that we can speculate on, but it'll be completely different from what we know now. And then the last great day, to understand that God is going to raise all those who died without knowing the meaning of life, having opportunity to become part of God's family. The billions of people. I don't know if you've ever thought who you might want to see and meet and learn from or even teach. Family members. Notables of history. But what we see is not only God's purpose, but what is possible. And all of that is what we need to live in. I mentioned the winter months can be bleak reminders that we don't have much. And I find no small irony in the fact that almost all of the pagan holidays are during this time of year when we have none of God's holy days. Halloween officially was yesterday, last night. And I'm done with the decorations. I'm done with the awfulness of what it projects. None of that would be tolerated any time the rest of the year, but it's celebrated for a season. But even Christmas and New Year's and Easter, they all have their own problems, if you will, when you look at the core of what they're teaching. And so we can just sort of tolerate things for a time. And I don't want us to tolerate. God recorded the Old Testament especially based on the rhythms of life where Israel lived, right? So the northern hemisphere, the weather patterns, the seasons, and so forth, all play into how God laid this out as a type for us to understand and learn from. But the culture and the history of Israel is not ours, right? It was a different life. It was a different world, if you will. But even so, there are things that we can learn from it. Israel was much more agrarian, like this nation was, you know, even as short as, you know, what, 70 years ago. We're more technologically and manufacturally advanced and focused, if you will. But there are lessons to learn from agricultural seasons. You know, we got into September this year, and I kept looking at the farmers' fields, and it's like, well, when are they going to harvest? And I'm thinking, well, it looks done. Why aren't they harvesting? Well, they weren't ready to harvest, and they didn't start harvesting until we were about ready to leave for the feast, right? Then they get out, and they're combining everything and preparing for that harvest. God's calendar is always on time. It's us that sometimes forget that. Even the weather, I was looking at the trees, and it's like, why are the trees not changing color? We got into September, and it's like, it seems the right weather. No, it wasn't ready for that time either. And that starts to turn before we left, and when we come back, all the leaves are gone. So we missed most of that color, but it was the right season, wasn't it? So from our perspective, the growing and work season is done for the year. But even in Judea, that wasn't the case. There was a lot to be done over the winter months. Even though the greater harvest was done, there was still a lot of work that was going to be done. And that's what I want to cover today. I think there are great spiritual parallels in considering what we should be doing over the winter months. And so the title of my message today is simply Winter Work. Winter Work. What should we be doing in the coming months before we start, once again, our annual review of God's holy days? In looking at any career from the outside, it's been my observation now for some decades that anybody that knows how to do their job well makes it look easy, right? Anybody can be a truck driver until you get all that weight behind you and all the knuckleheads that are driving on the highway, not paying attention, even in a small car. I'm just surprised how many people don't pay attention. How hard is it to be a seamstress? How hard is it to be a salesman? How hard is it to run a cash register? All of that seems easy if you don't have to do it and you don't know what you're doing. The reality is, to do any job well, it takes work, doesn't it? It takes skill. It takes practice, at least, to get good at it. When skills are applied with hard work, then it should look easy, right? Because you know how to do it. You're not wasting effort or time. You know the ins and outs, the little tricks, if you will. But it's also interesting to consider that what we think should be the case of how people should think, it's part of what we covered this morning, it's not always how people think. I'll give you a couple of examples to consider. Thomas Edison, I think almost everybody knows who that was, famous inventor here in this country back in the early 1900s, world-renowned. He began his career as a telegraph operator, of all things. He didn't start out as an inventor, but he chose to be a telegraph operator. I don't know if you've ever looked into this. He chose it specifically because it gave him time. He specifically chose the overnight shift to be a telegraph operator because then he could work on his other stuff that he wanted to do, right, while he was getting paid to do something. But he patented a number of different things. His very first patent was for an electric vote recorder, right? We still argue over that, whether we should have electronic voting machines or whatnot, but that was his first patent. He eventually built his own research laboratory in Menlo Park, New Jersey, in part because at that time that was out in the middle of nowhere, but yet relatively close to some major cities. And he invented a number of things. The phonograph, contributed to the telephone, created the first commercially practical incandescent light bulb, which completely changed how we live, doesn't it? Thousands of other inventions. We have someone like Leonardo da Vinci as well. He's most famous as a painter. I don't know how many of you have seen the Mona Lisa. It's actually not a very big painting. I expected it to be, you know, fairly large. It's not. It's relatively small. But it captivates people's attention, doesn't it? Because of not only the style, but the execution, how well he did it. And perhaps his most famous piece is The Last Supper, which isn't even painted on canvas. It's painted on a wall, plaster. That's a very difficult process. But he was truly what we call a Renaissance man. I mean, in the Renaissance, a Renaissance man meant to be able to do a lot of different things very well. And he did. He studied, studied botany, anatomy, civil engineering, geology, optics, hydrodynamics. He created, I found this very interesting when I looked into his life. He created an automatic bobbin winder. And this is the 1500s. But that was revolutionary. And one of the things that I find very interesting as well, he also invented a machine to test the tensile strength of wire, which is important to know, right? If you're trying to build or use wire in industrial settings, you need to know how strong it is because you can create a lot of problems if it breaks and you don't want it to break. And another one from our history early in this country, George W. Carver, came out of the Civil War time period as a free slave. And he decided that he wanted to learn from the world around him because he wanted to help his fellow man, slaves, be able to earn a living, to have a life. And he chose, as many of you probably are as well, the humble peanut plant. And he decided to follow that down the rabbit hole to see all the things that a peanut plant could be used for. Why did he pick a peanut plant? It was easy to grow. And if he could show a lot of different commercial uses for it, it'd be an easy way, if you will, a viable way for slaves to be able to have a life to pay for them things themselves. He disseminated it around 105 recipes of different uses of peanuts. For the oils, certainly, to eat, obviously, but in use in paints and many other different things. And then he also went on to receive a master's degree at Iowa State University in biology. He became the first black faculty member of the Iowa State University. And what really gave him notoriety, most people think it's the peanut plant, but actually what gave him notoriety at the time was his work in crop rotation and diversification. Because it was not uncommon in the South, tobacco or plants like that, and they would just year after year after year after year, and then the soil would wear out. But he did a lot of work on crop rotation and building up soil. He spent a lifetime helping black farmers grow crops they could make a living of. It wasn't just peanuts, but that was a major one. He later taught at Tuskegee Institute for 47 years, and it said that he developed more than 145 products from the peanut plant alone that could be used. Why do I mention these men? What do they have in common? Well, they never stopped working, and they never stopped growing in their field of endeavor. Going back to the idea of winter work in Judea, even though they did the main harvest this time of year, the fall, there was a lot of work that needed to be done afterwards. The time around the holy days saw harvesting of grains, obviously, but also other things. Figs, pomegranates. I saw my first live in the wild, if you will, pomegranate plant in Crete. I'd never seen one naturally. But pomegranates, dates, among other things. Certainly the farmers needed to prepare the fields after harvesting, right? You need to go back in, even if it's cleaning up. One of the things I see the farmer do, he usually does it in the spring, but he drives his little bobcat around. He's picking up all the stones that have worked up through the soil so they don't damage his machines when he comes through in the spring. So there's that work that needs to be done. The ground doesn't freeze there like it can here, so it's a little different. But maybe clearing additional land for future crops. It could include maintenance, like I mentioned, of removing stones or weeds or repairing walls. But also fields could be plowed and planted. We don't think of that much here, but it's not uncommon in areas like Judea that you would plant what's called a winter crop. And the primary winter crop in Judea was winter barley, which comes into play with the spring holy days. The barley harvest is the harvest of the wave sheaf offering that initiates the harvest in the spring. So all of that needed to be done. There's also what they called the early rains. That term can be confusing at times, but early in the planting season. So the early rains would soften the ground, giving moisture to the plants, these winter crops. There's obviously equipment that needs to be serviced, animals that need to be taken care of, harnesses that might need to be repaired, all of these things that may not be able to be done during the year because you're busy taking care of the fields or the animals. But even so, beyond that, harvested crops would need to be taken care of, all right? You brought them in, you harvested, what are you doing with them now? Maybe you store some, as was done, up until about 40 years ago, I knew farmers that always would calculate a percentage of whatever they were growing, wheat or soybeans or corn, and it would be called seed corn or for the next year's crop. They didn't buy it from some corporation. They would save what they had grown, right? So there's that part of it that you would need to do, but how much are you going to sell? How much are you going to store for future sale? How much do you need for your animals or whatever else that you're going to do? And so around October and November, there were olives to harvest, figs to harvest. I mentioned the barley that needed to be planted. And so then midwinter, what would be like December, beginning of January up here, they would have the citrus harvest, so oranges and such. And then the late rains would come, which is more towards the springtime, which would again soften up the ground and finish those things growing over the wintertime. And so then come March, April, there was the preparation for the barley harvest, then moving into repeating the whole cycle again. So the winter months were certainly not a time of laying around and waiting. There was a lot of work to be done. Let's go to John chapter 14. Not a lot of verses I'm going to cover today, but I want us to give some thought to this matter of winter work and what it looks like, if you will, for us personally. Jesus Christ is certainly an example of continual spiritual work. We have no record of him just walking away and not doing things. There were times he separated to recharge, to spend time with his Father. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about him saying, I'm just checking out, right? Next 2 months, I'm not going to do anything. He was always working. He even said that. I came to do the Father's work, his will. So we read of him not only preaching the gospel message, but traveling. There's no public transportation to take, right? There's no train, there's no buses, even in a car. He was walking. And so I've often wondered how physically fit those individuals were when you consider all the walking they did. But in addition to that, the healing of the sick that he did, the casting out of demons, the times he spent at the temple teaching, interacting even with the priests. And so in John 14, and in verse 12, we read this. He says, "Most assuredly, I say to you, he who believes in me, the works that I do, he will do as well." Well, there's a question for each of us. Am I doing the work that Christ is doing or did do? All of these things. We may not preach in the same way. We may not heal individuals as he did. We may not cast out demons or teach at a temple. But do we reflect what he's teaching? Do we model that to others? You know, it's been said, one of these sayings that sort of sticks in my mind anyway, the greatest sermon I ever heard was one that I saw. Something along that line. I probably butchered that saying up. But essentially it's that, you know, it doesn't matter what you say, it's what I see you do. Right? We can undermine credibility greatly by not following through on what we're saying. Hypocrisy is something that nobody likes. And so we see here, he says that you're going to do the same works. But notice as we continue, and greater works than these he will do because I go to my Father. The reason the greater works could be done by us is because he's now able to send the Spirit. Right? But even in practical sense, look at the reach that we have because of the internet. We have people popping up in Bangladesh and in Pakistan and in Myanmar and in all of these places in Southeast Asia. We have no presence there. Right? There's no minister. There's no church congregation. There's no magazine going into these areas. In fact, in some of these countries like Pakistan, we would get in trouble if we show up and start preaching Christianity, at the very least, if not being thrown in prison. And yet, God is blessing that, obviously, but we've put that out there because of the money that he's provided. That's just one such area. Look at the global reach we have with anything we put on the internet. It's not just print, it's video and other study materials, if you will. Look at how we can travel. We were in Crete, you know, 13 hours of flying. That's a day, right? You go to the airport, you might need to make one or two stops, but in a day, I can be literally halfway around the world. You can go to Australia. I know some went to Australia for the feast. That's a longer flight, but still, right? A day, you're there. How far could you get in a day in the time of Jesus Christ? 25 miles? That sounds like a lot to us, but I mean, these people were, again, used to doing that. They could travel. But look at the reach that we have, and I think this is part of what God is talking about. Also, greater works than these in the sense that there will be more people to do it. I mean, how many people, going back to Acts 1, how many people actually got the vision of what Christ was teaching? It says 120. That didn't seem like a good return on his time, but he was planting something, wasn't he? And growth doesn't always come at once, but look at the reach that we have just because of the people, if you will, and the impact that we can have even in our example at times. There's at least 11 times in John's gospel account here where Jesus is recorded about talking about his or his Father's work. And we're called to follow his example. Notice if we go next to Matthew 24. Matthew 24, of course, the disciples at the beginning of the chapter had asked Christ about signs of the end. You know, when will the end time come? And he goes through this in great detail. And then we get to verse 46, because he goes through the tribulation period. He talks about his coming and people not knowing. And then he uses this illustration of the fig tree and then reminds us no one's going to know specifically except the Father when he's going to return. And then in verse 46, so Matthew 24, verse 46, he says, "Blessed is that servant," he's talking about a faithful servant compared to an unfaithful servant. He said, "Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing." So I suspect anybody that's worked pretty much anywhere, but it's more probably more typical in an office environment, you've known people who will get very energetic when they know the boss is coming around. Right? And when the boss isn't there, they're not going to be so energetic. Right? They're working for the boss. They want to show the boss, but they're not really doing the work. We don't know. Going back up to verse 36 and so forth in that regard, we don't know when Christ is returning. Are we just kind of holding on and we'll give it our best? We'll blast it out right before the end. We're probably not going to know when the end is. So we have to be faithful so that whenever he comes, he will find us so doing. So doing what? Well, what we read in John 14, doing the work that he's doing, following through and doing the same thing. And so then in chapter 25, at the end of that chapter, second half, if you will, we have the parable of the talents, which is always very interesting to me. The point of that parable is, what are we doing with what we've been given? Right? The quantity of what we're giving is less important than what we're doing with what we've been given. Because the one that had five doubled it, the one that had two doubled it, Christ said the same thing. The master said the same thing to both of them, didn't he? Well done. The one that only had one was fearful. He went and hid it. And he said, you wicked servant, you could have at least got me interest, right? Even not doing anything with it. You could have given it to the money changers. And that's what we read of in verses 14 through the end of the chapter there in 25. What are we doing? He's looking for effort. He's looking for work. He's looking for us to follow through on what Christ did as well, to follow his example. Let's put a fine point on that in 1 Thessalonians 4. 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 10. Paul here writes, he says, and indeed, you do so towards all the brethren. He's talking about his conduct here. To remember how we show people God's way of life. And so he says, the end of the verse is what I want to focus on. But we urge you, brethren, that you increase more and more. It's not enough to increase. We have to increase more. That's not saying that God's never satisfied. I think the caution is towards our human nature. Because we can get to a point where we think, I've done enough. Right? And there's nothing worse in my estimation as a pastor, as an elder, to hear somebody say, I'm good. And I've had people essentially say that to me. That's the caution against Laodicea, isn't it? I'm good enough. And if we think we're good enough, then usually we start sliding. Right? Because I used to be a graphic artist. I couldn't be. Probably it'd take me a really hard struggle, steep learning curve to get back into that field because it's been 20 years. I haven't used those skills. Technology's moved on. The software's different. The deadlines are different. The model of how that work is done, it's all different. Everything's changed. So I can't rest on what I used to have. I have to keep current, don't I? I have to keep learning and growing. Part of that work, if you will, that God is looking for us, we find in John 15 a perspective. Mr. Shaby talked about this during the feast in his message, this matter of how we love one another. I think that is probably going to be our biggest public proclamation in the end time, how we love one another, because love in the world is dying, right? There's no care. There's no concern. It's very much, it's not completely awful yet, but the general focus and perspective is, if you will, is I'm going to take care of myself. Everybody else is on their own. I'm going to take care of myself. To the point where if we have neighbors that step up and help us, it's very notable, isn't it? So I think some of you are aware of my lawnmower woes this summer. My riding lawnmower needed to be serviced. So I've got more than 1.6 acres, and I mow most of that. And a riding mower is really nice. Right? I can mow the whole yard in less than 3 yards, and I'm done with it. And I don't have to walk very much. Well, it needed to be serviced. Blades needed to be sharpened. Oil needed to be changed, all this stuff. So I took it into a local place that does this. it took them a couple of weeks, of course, because it's middle of the season and a lot of people are needing repairs and whatnot. And I get it back and all was good. It was running really good, better than it had in a long time. And I mowed my grass and that was all good. A week or so later, I need to mow the grass again. I get it out and I don't go more than probably about 50 feet and I'm smelling smoke. It's like, I don't have anything in the burn pit. I was back by the burn pit. I don't have anything in the burn pit. Where's that coming from? I'm looking around. It's coming out from underneath the cowling of the tractor. So I shut it off real quick, open it up. Sure enough, I checked the dipstick, no oil. When they changed the oil, they didn't put the fitting on tight enough. It had been slowly leaking oil. And where I park it, I couldn't tell. I didn't notice that it was leaking oil. The engine seized up, no oil. So then I have to call them up. Fortunately, they admitted it was their fault, but it took me a month to get it back in the middle of summer. And it was a wet enough year, grass is growing like crazy. So I had the push mower I could do around the house, but to mow the whole yard, I didn't have that kind of time with a push mower, with everything else that was going on. It finally got up to about mid-calf in terms of height, and I had to get the backyard cut. I just had to get it cut. So I tried with the weed trimmer. Oh, boy, I have a battery weed trimmer. That lasted about 10 minutes. You know, the tall grass, it just gave up. And so then I get out. I call it a bush hog. It's a weed trimmer that my father-in-law gave me that's on wheels. It's got, you know, an engine behind it, gas-powered. It's got longer strings. It can handle the tougher stuff. It was working, but it was taking me forever. So I finally said, okay, I'm just going to have to bite the bullet. Got out my push mower. And I'm just slogging through it. And it's, you know, really slow because you have to let it cut. You have to let it get in the bag. And I'm emptying the bag every 5 minutes. You know, it's just this constant thing. My neighbor happened to look out the window because I'm in the backyard. He happened to look out. He's hearing me go at this. I don't know how long he was hearing me. He finally comes over and he says, you need some help? And I said, well, yeah, I could do that. But he's got a zero turn. My backyard's got some wet spots in it. I said, I don't know that you can get your zero turn back here. He says, well, I'll just be really careful with it. And I said, well, if you're going to do that, I showed him, come down that side of the yard that way and come across this way. It was drier areas. So he did. And in 10 minutes, he had my whole backyard cut. Now, it's a mess because the grass was this tall. He just bush hogged the whole thing. But it was done, right? I still had to rake it all, but it was done. That's notable. Nobody else came and offered to help cut my grass. And nobody else seemed to be concerned about it. But neighbor helping neighbor. John 15, verse 17. Family, these things that command you, notice, that you love one another. We may not have the agricultural perspective or need that this nation used to have, that Israel basically had as a culture. So we may not be repairing walls and clearing fields and worrying about what we're going to do with the stuff that we harvested and all that sort of thing. But this is work too, that you love one another. That's challenging at times, isn't it? We don't think the same. I think one of the biggest difficulties we have in our interpersonal relationships is that we think everybody thinks like we think. And most people don't think like we think. I'm talking about me personally, right? And the more obtuse you get, the less people are going to think like you. But to love one another, that's a directive, isn't it? And love is a verb, not a noun. So it's something that we have to put in action, something we have to practice, something we have to do. It requires effort. Because some people take more effort to love than others. But it takes effort to have the desire, doesn't it? It takes effort to understand who they are as a person and how to love them the way they need to be loved. So we read of this as well in Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews 10 and verse 24. We find here it says, and let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works. That's a better translation than the King James. The King James says, provoke one another. So I had four brothers. I understood how to provoke. It's not talking provoke in a bad way, right? But stirring up, to take something and make it better. You know, one of the jobs I had when I was still in my parents' house before I went off to college and so forth, just growing up, was to tend the fire. We heated that one end of the house with a fireplace, later a stove, and you could have the fire almost completely gone, You'd clear out some of the ash, the stuff that was truly dead. You'd save the embers. You'd put them in a pile. You'd put some tinder on top. You'd take the billows and blow on it a couple of times, and the fire just takes off, right? That's what I see in this. Stir up love and good works. Nurture the relationships. Invest the time. He even goes on to use an example in verse 25, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together. Because if we're never together, how are you going to love each other? You have to do that in person, don't you? Again, love is a verb. How am I going to love somebody to the level that I should if I'm never around them, if I'm never serving them? So we see this as well in Galatians chapter 5. One of the ways we love one another is to serve one another. Galatians 5 in verse 13. For you, brethren, have been called to liberty. Right? This verse rang to me back in 95. I know that predates some of you. But in the division that happened within the church back then, there were too many people that said they were happy to see the changes coming because their view of what God was expecting of them was too much of a burden. Right? The Sabbath was too much of a burden. Tithing was too much of a burden. All these things were too much of a burden. And I even said to some at the time, well, you're doing it wrong then. Right? They didn't see that. But liberty means we're free. We know what we're free to not have to do. I don't have to go out and experience all the bad things of life. I don't have to learn every lesson the hard way. I can listen to God and say, well, I have liberty not to choose that. I know. But he says, only do not use liberty as an opportunity for the flesh. All right, even liberty in knowing that we have forgiveness of our sins. Does that mean we can go sin willfully and then go to God and say, I apologize, and he's got to forgive us? Not necessarily. That's an opportunity for the flesh, isn't it? But notice, but through love, serve one another. So we just read about love in John 15. And then Hebrews, we're told to stir that up. One of the ways that we use it then here is the ending of this verse here. Galatians 5:13. Through love, serve one another. And again, that service can be in a general nature, but it can also be very specific for the person. Right? How I serve you in love can be different than how I serve somebody else in love. The needs are different. They can be different. And so then also in Ephesians 4, I'll just kind of quote this one to you. It also says to bear with one another. Sometimes love is just bearing with one another, right? We're having a bad day. They still love us. But I'm going to give you some space. Right? Sometimes love is just letting you be for a while so that you can come back in a better place. But bearing with one another also means going back to Hebrews 10, verse 25, of being in the fellowship so that you know what the other person is going through. Right? I can bear with you through a job loss, through a health trials, through whatever circumstances that are impinging, if you will, on you, to know what I need to pray for, to be a comfort, to maybe just sit and listen. Don't do anything. Just sit and listen to know that somebody cares. That's love as well. So let's go back to John chapter 9 this time. John's Gospel, verse chapter 9. Because as I alluded to in referencing the beginning part of Matthew 24, when Christ was giving the disciples an overview of what the end time would look like and what some of the challenges would be, he also mentioned later in the chapter that no one would know when he's coming. So we touched on those things. In John 9, we come back to that thought. John 9 and in verse 4, Christ here says that he says, I must work the works of him who sent me. Right? That's my focus, he says. That's where my mind is. This is my number one priority. I have to be doing this. Notice, while it is day. So one of the individuals I highlighted earlier was Thomas Edison. I mentioned the light bulb changed everything. It did, didn't it? Because the world before that, I mean, you had lamps, but those were expensive. The oil was expensive. And for most people, the overwhelming majority of the population around the world, you started before the sun came up because you would gain light as you worked. And when the end of the day came, you had to stop. There was no light. You couldn't do anything. You didn't know what was where, when, you know, so you'd get in trouble sometimes. You might get yourself in danger. So the day stopped, at least outdoors. So he's reminding us here, work while it is day. Work while you have the time. Right? To push things down the road, we all do it. I can do that tomorrow. I'll do that later. And oftentimes that works out, but sometimes it doesn't. Later throws you a surprise and you can't get to it. So he says, do this while it is day, notice, for the night is coming when no one can work. There's going to be a time as a church, we are not going to be able to do a work. Right? The world is heading that direction already. I mentioned the internet and the great impact we have. And the downside of the internet is that if somebody decides they don't like what we're saying, all they got to do is flip a switch and we're dead. Right? There is no UCG website. We already have to be careful with search engines. When we place ads for the Beyond Today videos or different things that we might want to promote to entice in the right way people to come to the website, there are certain keywords and key phrases we can't use. We'll get banned from the search engines. And it's not that it's terribly awful, it's just that it's not politically correct. Right? It's not the right words, or the words are used the way they're not comfortable with. So there's going to come a time when we're not going to be able to do a work. So we have to do a work when we can, right? To accomplish what we can accomplish now while we can. This is collectively, but certainly, and probably more importantly, individually. The coming months, then, are not just a time of simply waiting for spring. I fall into that pattern. I struggle with SAD, seasonal affective disorder. So I have 5,000 Kelvin wavelength light bulbs in my lamps on my desk. And I have to remind myself in the wintertime, time for a break. I go up, I stand by the back door, and I just close my eyes and stand in the sun. Because winter's hard for me. I don't like winter. But I still have to get things done, don't I? So you make adjustments. You make it happen. You refocus from doing outside work to inside work. And all these things to do. And I just want to highlight this. I did this a little bit in my Sabbath thought last night. But with all the messages given in the last month and a half, and depending on how you slice the time, the numbers can be a little different. But we received in the past month and a half more biblical instruction than about 6 months of Sabbaths previously. All compressed down into that time. The sermonettes, the sermons, the Bible studies, or whatever else was taking place. That's a lot of instruction, isn't it? So these coming months offer a time to review, to study, to practice the things that we heard, things that we read. There's still work to be done in serving each other in the congregation, serving one another in love, bearing with one another. That takes practice to know how to do that, to do it right. There's still work to be done in the end time to live and preach the gospel message, especially our example. We need to prepare for the review of God's holy days that will begin again next spring, to anticipate that, be considering those things again. I would encourage all of us to make the most of this Sabbath day and each one that will follow until we once again begin the rehearsal of God's plan of salvation in his holy days. And to the point of what Christ said, let us be always mindful to be doing the work that we need to be doing while there is time to do it.